I'm Rochelle Jackson. Welcome to The Crime Couch. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author, and I know who's who in the zoo, the crims, the cops, and the interesting individuals in between. So get comfy and join me each week on The Crime Couch for a rollicking, intriguing tale. It'll be one heck of a journey. Rick Killer Kalicheski is a former prison guard. For more than 30 years, he's worked in some of Australia's toughest jails, Pentridge, Loddon and Ararat prisons, and in the prison dog squads. He's looked after some of Australia's highest profile crooks, including cop killers Bandelli Debs and Jason Roberts, standover man and drug dealer Victor Pierce, and contract killer Lewis Kane. Well, we're sitting in Rick's lounge room on a lovely sunny day in country Victoria. Hi, Rick. Thanks very much for sitting on the crime couch with me today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rochelle.
Tell me, why did you become a prison guard?
Prior to becoming a prison guard, I was in the taxi industry, and I thought the bottom was going to drop out of it there. I was getting to my early 30s, and I was looking for a job with a little bit of security, and I saw this advertised in the paper, and I applied for it, and I got it, and I started work at the prison service in December 1983.
And was it what you expected?
It was what I expected. It's a completely different way of life in prison and what outside. And being in the taxi industry was probably a pretty good training for what I was about to find in prisons.
Now, I've got to ask you, Rick, your nickname, Killer Kalicheski. How did you get the nickname Killer?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story, Rochelle. Everyone in the system there, including a lot of the prisoners, probably think it's because of my physical prowess or something like that. But actually, it's the second time that I ever went into Pentridge. I went into B Division to have a look around. It was the first day in uniform and I was still out of the training college. I walked into a fight between two prisoners, and one of them had been stabbed with a large knife, and the knife came sailing down off the top tier in B Division and landed near me, and an officer in there in B Division asked me to grab the knife, which I did. And I put the knife in a drawer and secured it there so nobody else could get hold of it. Now, when I got back to the college there, the trainers there were calling me the Killer because my fingerprints were all over the knife. I'd picked the knife up. I hadn't had any training. I'd picked it up by the handle. Probably ruined a lot of the fingerprints that were already on there. So I became the Killer, and it stuck with me from day one till the very end of my career.
Unbelievable. Everyone gets stuck with a nickname, don't they, whether it's in the police service or in the prison system. Tell me, what was Pentridge like? Because that's where you served at the start of your career, in about 1983. What was prison like life in Pentridge around the 1980s, Rick?
Yeah, it was a very violent sort of a place there. There was absolutely no love lost between the prisoners and the prison officers. There were incidents occurring all the time, serious ones, prisoners being stabbed and beaten up badly on a very regular basis. It's probably a little bit confronting for some people. In fact, the day of the incident where I got my nickname there, several people who were on the course with me never came back.
Really? Why was that?
It wasn't what they were expecting to run into, somebody getting stabbed. They couldn't handle it and never returned to the training course.
I remember too, when I did the book on Billy Longley, he talked about being in H Division and how frightening that was to be in such a tough division. Obviously, he's a convicted murderer, but he said he had to run the gamut Was that something that was de rigueur in prison?
Oh, look, I had the opportunity to fill in H Division a few times. It was very much a closed shop. What went on in there, nobody ever found out about. It was run like virtually like a military prison. It was very strict discipline on the prisoners. They had to do exactly how they were told, or suffer the consequences. If you know what I mean. And if you went in there and you worked there because somebody didn't turn up to work, you were usually put up into a tower, out of the way of all the rest of the stuff that was going on, and you just walked along a catwalk, overlooking all the yards, run-out yards for where the prisoners were put during the daytime. So anything else that happened in there, you just didn't get to see.
Police in those days, in the 1980s and 90s, they were very quick when they were dealing with the crims to show who was boss, weren't they? How did the prison guards, how did you control the crooks and control the inmates?
Look, in the H Division environment there, it was very, very easy. It ran like a military prison. You stood where you had to stand. You did what you had to do. You lifted this hand when you were told to lift this hand. You walked this way when you were told to walk this way. There were certain rules where you weren't allowed to walk on the centre of the division, H Division. You had to stay to the left of the red line, otherwise you'd suffer the consequences. You did exactly what you were told and nothing else. For general duties officers, it was a little bit harder. You were thrown out there amongst the prisoners there and you managed it the best way you could. They weren't all difficult people to manage, but look, I found it the way it worked for me was to be very consistent with them, treat them how they treated me, and not be vindictive about anything and just treat them like ordinary people in a different environment.
Were gangs an issue in those days, Rick? And if so, what sort of gangs did they have?
Yeah, look, when I started in 83 there, it was probably getting towards the end of the Overcote gang stuff. I didn't really understand it. I used to see these guys walking around with the big overcoats on there and looking rather tense, and it sort of give you an indication that something was about to happen, and it usually did. They were usually carrying weapons inside the big coats.
So that was one of the gangs, wasn't it, the overcoat gang?
Yeah, and that's about most of the stuff that I saw. It evolved from there, and you ended up with the POWs, and I believe there's now, after I've left, there's gang stuff is pretty rife in prisons. So.
Tell me when you started. Were guns and drugs an issue then, Rick?
Guns, not so much, although there was guns thrown over the wall into Pentridge there while I was working there.
God, what happened?
Well, lucky they didn't get over both walls. They landed in between the two security fences there and we just went down and picked them up. There had been other guns smuggled in and were found in Port Phillip Prison. Handguns found in visitors' cars, but guns, knives were the issue for us, not so much guns. Drugs were rife, and that formed a large part of my job when I went on to join the dog squad, which I'll go on about a little bit later.
and so I'd imagine a lot of searching cells, searching of persons?
Yes, that's correct.
And what was the main sort of drugs that in those early days in your career, what were the main drugs that were the big problem?
Cannabis, all forms of cannabis, hash, GVM and hash oil and all those sort of things, and speed and heroin was a big one.
Okay, so
You spent a long period of your time in Pentridge, and then you worked in some of the other country prisons as well. How long did you end up spending in the system? And tell me, were there any times that you actually feared for your life, Rick?
Oh, yeah, many, many times. I had a few. At the end of the 80s, there was a pretty disruptive time in the prison system there, and we had a riot in the late 80s there, and we were the ones, after I joined the dog squad, who were taking the prisoners involved in the riot to court every day, and we had countless physical encounters trying to get them in the vehicle, and they would, as soon as the jury walked out in the courts and that, they would get up and threaten us, even in front of the judge, that they were going to get us and kill us. I was involved in a couple of other incidents, and somebody followed me home one night, and I parked my car, and someone fired a shot through the driver's side window of the car. I didn't hear anything. I'd just gone in the house and went to bed, and my young son came out and said, Dad, did you hear that? And we went out and had a look at the car, had the hole in the side window there, and when I hunted around, I even found the projectile inside the car. And then I...
Did you find out who did it?
No, I didn't, but I can probably narrow it down to probably two people who were behind it. Obviously, they didn't do it because they were in jail. And
do you know what that was in retaliation about?
Yeah, just encounters we'd had. One particular fella there had threatened to kill me a number of times for using a minimum amount of physical force. I'd taken him down to hospital one day there, and he moved away from the area he was supposed to be sitting, so I asked him to move back, and he refused. And in the end there, I went over and grabbed him and took him back physically back over to where he's supposed to be. He threatened to kill me, and he did six or seven times in various confrontations we had after that. Look, it could have been him, or it could have been another person I'd been involved in an incident with around about the same time. Yeah,
it must be very frightening going to work, knowing that you're going into those explosive situations. How do you protect yourself as a prison guard when you've got those sort of threats coming, and that's a daily thing?
Yeah, look, in those two particular, there was two particular occasions there where I had the police watching my house, and I had no doubt what I would do if somebody had come to my door. You've got your family and your kids and all that there, so if somebody went to the trouble to track you to your house and knock on your door, they're not going to be there wanting a cup of tea, so... I would take appropriate action.
You had a lot of dealings with the contract killer, Lewis Cain.
Yeah.
How would you describe Lewis Cain, Rick?
Well, the first time I saw Lewis Cain, he was running out the side door of the Supreme Court there with a prison officer chasing him. I was in a vehicle providing additional security to the county court van on that particular morning. Cain turned left as he came out the door and ran up Lonsdale Street and started to go left into William Street, and I'd bailed out and started chasing him. And the guys in the van in front of us had seen what was going on, and they cut him off in William Street. He ran back towards me, but on an angle towards the county court, the opposite corner. And as he was going past me, I pulled my gun out and said, "Stop, I'll shoot you." And he just said, shoot me then. And obviously he knew that I couldn't shoot him because there were so many people there, and I just wouldn't take the chance of hurting somebody else. He ran down Lonsdale Street, and probably for a good couple of hundred metres, and he saw a couple of police security officers coming up the road there in the opposite direction towards him, and he did a quick turn and ran across the road there in front of all the traffic and up a laneway, and I followed him obviously, and when I got through the cars parked in the middle of the road, I ran smack bang into a car that was going up the road there, and I bounced off the bonnet. My gun it bounced on the front of the bonnet, and it must have scared the living daylights out of the person who was driving the vehicle. But I was luckily I could get up and kept going, and by that time there were other prison officers catching up, and as Kane was running down the laneway there, I told him, stop, I'll shoot again, and I could have done it this time because that laneway back in those days had a dog leg in it, and he was running straight towards a brick wall. I stopped, and the officers next to me stopped too because they knew I was going to take a shot at him, and halfway through pulling the trigger on the revolver, which had a really long trigger pull, Kane fell over. So I just let my finger off the trigger there, and everybody jumped on him, and we got him back to the Supreme Court. Now,
what an incident! My God. So were you okay? Because you bounced off the bonnet of a car.
Yeah, I thought I was okay. And I went back there and wrote my report, and when I got up to do something, go to the toilet, I don't know, I can't remember what it was, I couldn't walk properly. So eventually the afternoon got back to Pentridge there and rang my boss, who was based up in Ararat, and told him what had happened. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get a pat on the back over this, and all he said to me was, now you know why I need you to be able to run. And I thought, well, that's pretty close to a pat on the back. And that's the way I always took it. Now, I had
my pretty next tough, though, like no medal for bravery.
Nah, well, how brave is it to shoot a man who's running away that you don't know? I mean, it was just my job, and I'm really glad I didn't have to
I bet.
Know, yeah, so... my next dealings with Kane were very, very cold and icy. I used to come across him around the prison there. He just gave me the cold stares. And then about 4 or 5 years later, I was called over to Acacia unit in Barwon there, which is a high security unit. Management cells he was playing up in there. And we entered the back of the cell that he was in through the exercise yard, and as soon as he saw me, he said, look, I'm not going to cause you any trouble.
Did he recall you? And
I'm not going to cause you any trouble, and he stopped, you know, he was playing up in the cell prior to that, and he said, look, I won't cause you any more problems. So we had a bit of a conversation, and as I was leaving, he said, you would have missed me on the day. You wouldn't have hit me. And I said, oh, look, I think I might have. And it started to come across as a bit of a confrontation between me and him, and another officer jumped in and said, hey, cut it out, Lewis, you know, cut it out, tone it down. And he just turned to the other officer and he said, Mr. C, I'll call him. He said, me and this man have experienced something in our lives that you could never understand. And he said, do you mind if we talk about it? And we just had a bit of a laugh and a joke and I walked out. Next time I saw him, was not too far down the track. He was still in the same place, for bad behaviour. And he said to me, oh, killer. He said, lucky you didn't shoot. And just prior to that...
So was that his idea of a joke?
No, well, just prior to that, I'd been in, I'd competed in the World Police and Fire Games, and I did very well in one of the shooting events. So the prison newspaper circulated through the prison would have my name in there, and he would have read the results. So he thought that was always the year of a joke. Yeah. So had, you know, a few casual run-ins, meetings with him over the years in various places, and we got you know, a little bit of a rapport going with us. And then just prior to him being released, on the day he was being released, I ran into him at Port Phillip Prison. And he was yelling out, killer, killer, I need to talk to you. So I went over and saw him and said, what's going on, Lewis? And he said, oh, he wanted to shake my hand. So I shook his hand. He said, look, on that day there, he said, you know, if you'd have shot me, he said, I wouldn't hold it against you. He said, I know you're only doing your job. And then he said, but you shouldn't have been able to catch me. He said, when I came flying out the side door of the court there was supposed to be a fella there on a motorbike, and he never turned up. He said, you just can't trust those crims. And we had a bit of a laugh, and I wished him good luck and said, you know, I hope you go all right, Lewis.
It sounds like you guys almost had a bit of a, you know, begrudging sort of respect for each other.
Well, it went on from there. So, and the next time I saw Lewis, it was outside. It was about 50 metres from where all this stuff had happened 14 years previously. I was parked outside the Melbourne Custody Centre, which was right opposite, you know, the Supreme Court where he'd taken off from. So I was standing outside the vehicle, and he's walked up and tapped me on the shoulder, and I've turned around, and it was Lewis Kane. And I got a bit of a start, you know, and he looked at me and said, g'day, killer, how you going? And he patted me on the stomach, and he said, do you reckon you could catch me now? And I looked at him and I said, I don't think so, Lewis, but I can still shoot. And I said, what are you going to do, mate? He goes, I don't really know. I said, what are you doing here? He said, I'm visiting a mate who's in the cells here. And he said, the only people I know are crooks, and I'll be back in jail. So unfortunately, probably a few months after that happened there, I heard that he'd been shot dead and dumped in a laneway in Brunswick. And I guess for some people, that'd be right whack, especially the relatives of the poor bloke that he kicked to death to be in jail in the first place. But, you know, I had a moment of sadness come across me for those, and every time I think about those brief moments in my life, it was only over a minute or two in my life, I have that feeling of sadness.
Of course, and it makes sense because, as you said, he was knocked off in 2004, and it was at the time it was thought he'd accepted a contract to take out Carlton crew member and former lawyer Mario Condello, and it was apparently as payback for the death of Benji Veneman.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, isn't it, the fact that he obviously had respect for you,
yeah,
and even though you're both on the other sides of the fence, yeah, you're different sides of the fence.
Yeah.
Did he have high status in prison, Lewis Kane?
Oh, look, not particularly, no. He was, you know, not particularly, no. He obviously could be a bit of a drama for staff to deal with, but no, you wouldn't put him up there with, you know, I can't really name, but
with other high status,
with other high status crims, no.
Yeah. So you sounds like you didn't actually really then manage him as such. Well, you managed him rather than tried to control him, and it sounded like he had some respect for you.
Oh, look, he had. I had the same amount of respect for him. I mean, especially after the day there where he said, look, I need to talk about this thing that happened. It was probably a minute in both of our lives that sort of probably changed our lives in some way there. And it formed a little bit of a bond between the two of us. I mean, as he said, I nearly died and you nearly killed me. And, you know, 30 years down the track, which it is now, this happened in 1990, I still get that little feeling of sadness when I think about it.
It's interesting, isn't it? One moment like that and one decision and it could have changed both your lives.
That's right. And as I said to him probably a couple of times, I said, Lewis, I'm glad I didn't have to shoot you. I said, because it would have made my life probably, you know, it would have changed my life considerably. You know, with all the stuff that happens when you get involved in one of those incidents there. So.
Interesting how you reflect on those times, isn't it? And just how one split decision can change your life forever.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right, Michelle, yeah.
Thank you very much for joining me on the Crime Couch today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining me. I'm Rochelle Jackson, and I look forward to your company next time on the Crime Couch.